Thank you, everybody, for braving the rain tonight. So I can see what I'm reading, so I can really see. Tonight, what I'd like to talk about is a kind of a sometimes an unusual topic, which is that of self-esteem. So, you know, we often hear in our conventional language, so-and-so, you know, lacks self-esteem. And the conventional definition is something like lacking confidence or ability to carry things through. Someone with low self-esteem, you know, might take some poor decisions for themselves, defer to others, feel self-conscious. When I asked people what they thought self-esteem was, that's what they came up with. And somebody who has difficulty being effective. Sometimes it might have had somebody, might have had some difficult upbringing or some lived through some difficult experiences in their past in some way. And then sometimes people might encourage that person to, you know, believe in themselves and stand up for themselves. Or, you know, some say, you know, they need to build skills to help bring confidence, develop confidence. And sometimes it might seem that as if these directives are kind of coming from a place outside of ourselves. It sounds like a good idea, but, you know, how do you do it? How does that work? And there's sort of this fake it till you make it mentality. You know, you just pretend and that'll come. And then, you know, it might look confident, but you don't really feel confident. You know, it's just nobody knows the difference. You know, no one knows about it. So I started thinking, you know, well, how does that relate to Buddhism? And, you know, on the face of it, it seems a little problematic. You know, well, if you look at Buddhism, one of the teachings of Buddhism is that there is no self. So, you know, if there's no self, you know, what is there to esteem? And, you know, what is low esteem or high self-esteem? I mean, maybe it's better to have low self-esteem, you know, be more humble, and maybe high self-esteem is not so good. You know, you're sort of full of yourself, and that doesn't sound so good. And then I look a little further, and then, you know, you learn about a small self and a big self. So now there's two selves. Oh my, you know, now this is really confusing. So then we're supposed to get rid of the little self and embrace the big self. But how is that supposed to happen? Who's doing the embracing? This is really getting confusing. So some folks might say, when I give up my little self, my conventional way of looking at the world, now, does that mean that I let people walk all over me? There's a story about a Buddhist monk who was walking on a forest path at the edge of a village, and he encountered a snake. And he taught the snake about the Dharma and about nonviolence. Then he went on his way. The snake thanked him for the teaching. A few weeks later, he returned on the same path, and he found his friend, the snake. And he said, "How's it going?" And the snake was all beaten up and bruised and miserable looking. And he asked with concern, "What happened?" And the snake replied, "Well, you taught me about the Dharma and nonviolence, and I embraced nonviolence. And then the kids in the village came by, and they realized that I wasn't going to harm them. And they came and started throwing things at me and beat me up." "Ah," the monk replied, "you know, I told you not to bite. I didn't tell you not to hiss." So Buddha taught the theory of interdependent origination. So the self is not a rigid, independent structure. It is only input from our senses that makes it seem so. This is what is meant by empty. It doesn't mean that there's nothing there. Rather, that it doesn't have an absolute reality that is fixed, that is unchanging. Rather, it presents a vast network of relationships, including our parents, brothers, sisters, grandparents, friends, children, work and maybe social relationships, society, and our planet, endlessly stretching out to infinity. The very bodies that we inhabit are made from long ago exploded stars. In fact, as we saw, two black holes colliding a few days ago. We heard them, rather. It's like a cloud that you can see from a distance and it looks solid, but on close inspection, as when you're in an airplane, it's just so many water molecules that you can't hold in your hand. You can see this very clearly when you're in the plane passes right through the wisps of the clouds. Or the power grid. There's power plants and end users, cables, but no actual location for the grid. And yet the lights turn on. Or the internet. Servers, cables, our collective participation. There's a sign on 101 that says, water, food, shelter, and internet. And it's true. We increasingly rely on the internet for our life functions. And yet there's no one called the internet. The internet is empty. Oh my. Well, I hope we still all have jobs tomorrow. So back to ourselves. Do we esteem it or not? And how? Dogen said, to study the self is to know the self. To know the self is to be one with all sentient beings and settle the self upon the self. So, I think that from the Buddhist point of view, consciousness of the self is true self-esteem. So observing the flow of energy in ourselves, where does it tend to get stuck? Where does it flow freely? Where do we resist giving, or perhaps resist taking, accepting help? Seeing how our habits and ways of thinking are generating, how they affect others, how they affect ourselves. Sometimes some old subroutines have outlived their usefulness and are only getting in our way. At some time in our lives, we maybe have developed a certain habit that was useful, perhaps, in getting something done. For example, for me, driving fast is one of them. Both literally and figuratively. I drive 100 miles an hour still. Maybe I'm down to about 80. At a certain time in my life, it came in handy. But now, I find it a little outdated. As I get older, I find it more exhausting. And I find that I want to spend more attention and time on one individual task. So I have to find ways to simplify my life somehow to allow that. The second one is sort of the habit of perfectionism. You know, I was taught, do it well or don't do it at all. Perhaps, and I think certainly appropriate consideration is necessary before any big undertaking, but sometimes we have to go ahead even in the face of uncertainty or imperfection. Nothing is ever really perfect. Even our definition of what that is changing. Sometimes if you don't start out, even imperfectly, the work remains undone, or you don't learn what you might have learned along the way. So maybe keeping going, however imperfectly, is the perfect thing. At least it'll get better. you know, another thing, some helpful habits I've picked up along the way was sort of this sort of dogged determination, what I call sort of the immigrant mentality, which is just keep going at all costs. And sometimes that's really useful, you know, but there's times where you kind of have to let it go and, you know, accept, cut your losses, you know. And even in relationships, especially with significant others, especially if you're right, might be just best to apologize at once. So allowing space can be helpful. You don't have to have an answer for everything, just trusting the process. And that's something that we learn in meditation. I think it's especially important in Zen practice, because you can't see thing, you can't see it with your thinking mind. You have to just do it. Just kind of jump in with both feet. So in this simple sitting practice, we slowly become accustomed to sitting quietly with one another. Our minds, our bodies, our lives, our families become accustomed. We learn to quiet our minds, allowing our awareness to expand beyond our sense organs, beyond our desires, our aversions, to be able to take in ever-widening vistas, ever-deepening levels of connection between each other, to hopefully be able to enjoy more peace and perhaps take better decisions. To do this, we need a mirror, a network to encourage us, to hold us while we learn to walk in this way. Just as a baby needs its mother to learn to walk, we need the support of our community, of each other, of a tradition, of those who have walked this way before, to know that it is possible, that it makes sense, to be able to trust. And that's how a sangha is formed, a kind of breathing network. Why do we need to keep showing up? Because Zen is fundamentally a verb. We shouldn't say we are practicing Zen. Rather, we should say we are Zenning. Through the interactions that happen every day, the kindness, attention, the compassion, the openness, the flower of Zen is born again and again and again, ever new, ever fresh. Making room for that in our hearts, minds, and lives, in our interactions with each other, with those whose paths we cross during the day, is practicing big mind, settling the self, the patterns of habits and thoughts we experience as me. To settle upon the self, the common source of our humanity. If I see you as myself, how can I hurt you? That doesn't mean just letting anything happen. On the contrary, it can mean taking a balanced action, including a corrective action if needed, to restore appropriate working of a complex system. We're like the bamboo in the forest, bending but not breaking in response to stress and change. We're able to develop true resilience, not just gritting through, but growing with it, allowing it to expand our capacity, our vision, and our connection with one another. So I read a little poem for you guys. Zenning. Unconditional spring of our nature, eternally flowing over hard rocks of habits and circumstance, eternally fresh, available, asking nothing. Here, have a sip. Thank you.
Thank you for your words. I was wondering if we can ask you about your 30 years of experience with Zen. Have there been times when it's been difficult to come back to Zen?
Sure. You mean just to come sit?
To keep Zenning.
To keep Zenning? Yes. Yes. I think it's difficult when you're very tired, you know, when you're exhausted. Sometimes it's good to sleep. That helps. I think it's challenging, you know. Kanando, I think, is a very special place, really, because most Zen centers are residential, you know, where people have such an intensive practice, or they're more, you know, less intense. They maybe sit once a week or something like that, or a couple of times a week. So they're sort of at both ends, and I think we're sort of in between, where people have very intense lives here in Silicon Valley, and they're practicing and raising a family and working really hard sometimes, and yet they manage to maintain a very thriving practice. So I think that can be difficult. There's always sort of a flow back and forth, like projects are due, boom, you kind of take care of those, you know, knock them out of the park, and then come back, you know, when more frequently. But I think I've tried to kind of keep a rhythm, even when things are really busy. Try to kind of keep coming back, even if I'm not able to come every day, but to try to keep coming regularly. That's been helpful.
Self-esteem, like high self-esteem or low self-esteem. I think of high or low self-esteem not as an amount, but as a quality, like high quality self-esteem or low, like high quality self-esteem would be like eating well, sleeping properly, you know, just treating yourself with kindness. And the golden rules to treat others as you would treat yourself, but oftentimes I treat myself worse than others, you know, so it's like treat myself as well as I would treat others, to try to improve the quality. That's how I think of self-esteem. I've been interested in your viewpoint or anybody's viewpoint.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that's a very good point. So we often treat others better than we treat ourselves. And I think that there may be one of the reasons sort of why people do have lower self-esteem is that self-critical voice, you know, that kind of causes you to feel in that way. So that is part of, in a sense, what you have to transcend or set aside or work through, is treating yourself as well as you would treat your best friend. Yeah. Thank you.
Bon. You talked about kind of the big self and the small self, and I was wondering, well, in these years of practice, you must have had some sense of feeling the big self and feeling the small self. And have you found a way that they can relate in a way, like, you know, that the big self can take care of the small self, or when the small self gets frustrated, it can kind of connect with the big self, or some way to kind of have a relationship between the two so you can hold them at the same time?
Sure. I think especially here in this practicing in a busy place, I think we're constantly kind of going back and forth between sort of functioning in a bigger self mode and then a smaller self mode. Well, you know, the big self isn't very good at negotiating traffic and answering emails, you know, this morning we were sitting and we went to Starbucks and had such a nice talk this morning. We were just enjoying ourselves, having very spiritual talk, and then it was 7:45, and I have to be at work at 9, and I have to drive home and change and drive back to work. So I'm like, okay, well, this is it. Okay, it's time for the small self to kick in. Thank you very much. And I was driving on 101 and I looked at the traffic and I looked at the HOV lane and I said, all right, there's only one way I'm going to get home in this time frame. I did some judicious HOV negotiation. So yeah, you know, I think you have to, you sometimes you have to, I think this is how I see it. And I don't know I don't know if there's an answer. Maybe somebody has a better answer of the big self and the little self, but sort of the small self is, you know, sometimes the one that has to take care of logistics. You know, that's what I think you're, you know, has to get you up in the morning and, you know, get dressed and kind of these habits that we have to develop of kind of has to take care of the body in a sense. It's your responsibility. Your body is your responsibility and your life is your responsibility. No one's going to pay your checks, your bills. You know, you have to take that responsibility, and that's the responsibility of the little self, you know. And but they interact because, you know, they each have their jobs. But if you use that small self to make all your decisions, you know, that's not going to work out so well, because then it's, what's in it for me? What do I get out of this before you, you know? And so that's that bigger perspective that's more important. So I think this, I don't see the small self as a bad thing. I just see it as not enough. That's kind of how I see it, you know? Yeah. Uma.
So what Bonnie's saying, I was thinking about that, and you were saying small self is needed, we do need it, and it's important. Even your need for taking the HOV line is a small self act, but it gets the job done. But the problem doesn't start there. The problem, I think, starts with most people is two things happen. Number one is that people don't know how to do things, and they identify with not knowing how to do things and feeling bad about it instead of learning how to do things. That's one thing that happens. And the other identification that takes place is that if something that they want, they see, and they don't have it, they feel bad about it. So, in essence, both of them have the similarity of having the identifying factor, that you're identifying it. I think when we were leaving from Sushin, I said to you that we usually want our boat in the water, we don't want the water in our boat, you know, because we'll be shoveling like crazy, and we'll be drowning. So when we come here or we sit in meditation, one of the first things that we do is sit there and things come by and we go, let it go, let it go, let it go, let it go, to a point where the self and the non-self lets go of everything. And then the big mind takes over, or the big self takes over. And from that point onwards come the better decisions, come the better values, I think. Because what you're doing is, I have to constantly, at work too, have to tell myself, things get hectic. Just let go of everything, relax. Just let everything go. If I react in that situation, I will create more harm than I will create more harmony. So no matter how anybody's reacting, I have to keep on reminding myself, let it go. Because your first reaction is not going to be the right reaction. Your second reaction is going to be the right reaction. And that's usually what takes over. But it takes coming and sitting and coming to realize that letting go happens when do you come and sit? And when do you come to realize that you don't have to identify with everything? If you make a mistake, yes, it's a sin that you made a mistake. But, you know, every teacher thing has told us that, you know, we learn from our mistakes. So guess what? You have to make a mistake, you have to sin to, you know, to get better. So this is what it comes down to. And that's why the problem, I think, for most people is that sometimes you have to do what you have to do. There's no, it's the right thing.
I think that's very, very right. Yeah. I think that process of identification with that is who I am, this is how I am, and I have to do this, and how can they say that to me, you know, that's...
Yeah, no situation does not work because, especially in customer service, it does not work. People come in and say to me, you know, you don't know anything, and I'm like, yes, thank you. How may I help you? Then they ask me the question that they really wanted to ask me. You know, say, okay, go ahead, punch. And when you're done punching, then, you know, I'll answer your question. What you want is what we'll get down to. And
yeah, thank you.
It comes from, like, you and I have had this conversation before, that you've had situations where you had to, like, hold back and just have to deal with it.
Sure.
Since you've practiced martial arts, you already know that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, thank you.
What is self for you?
What is
self?
Self for me? Presence, you know, that sort of, I think it's what you're present with. That's kind of what is in front of you, what is, you know, that awareness of whatever is present for you. And that can shift, you know. I think, you know, I'd love to say that I operate from a big self all the time. I don't think that's true. Joko Beck writes, you know, she's like, well, I'm lucky if I hit 80%, you know, that's pretty good on a good day. So if she's 80%, I'm probably a lot less than 80%. So it varies, but I think that's what self is where am I, what am I identifying with, right? That's asking yourself that question and being the person who's remaining aware of what you're identifying with at any given time. Where's my self? You know, where am I putting my consciousness and my presence? I think sort of being aware of that. Yeah.
A follow-up. So how do you distinguish between a bigger self and a smaller self?
There's no distinction. There's no distinction. I think there's no real distinction. I think it's just the act of presence. But I think that from taking the bigger perspective, you know, taking the more wholesome perspective. So it's kind of seeing from a bigger self perspective, I see you as me. So I will act in your interest because it's in my interest to do that because I see you as myself. So that's acting from a bigger self, okay? If I'm acting for the perspective of this body, like I need to keep this body out of the rain, then I'm acting from the perspective of my smaller self, right? So it's just a case of perspective, where you see as what your motivation is. Let's say. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
mention how you might fake it or pretend to be great and then kind of convince people that you are great. And I think that, you know, you see that all, I mean, I think as a child you learn that, right? You see that if you display a certain person, you can change people's perspective of you. So I was wondering, at what point in your life did you start to kind of let go of that? And can you talk about what kind of was a catalyst to that and what shifts you made?
I don't think I was ever really very good at pretending. Maybe, so kind of, I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, that sense of, you know, dressing, you know, for success and all that kind of stuff. But I think, yeah, I tried to do that when I first started working, you know. And I don't know if it did anything. I don't think it really did anything. I think it's more replaced by a sense of, at least at work, let's say. Let's use that as a example. It's replaced slowly by a sense of actual knowing what you're doing. what that person needs. Like if you're looking for a piece of equipment, you actually know where it is as opposed to just, you know, pretending like you know, and then asking someone, "Hey, do you know where that is?" Right. So I think often that sense of false confidence, that sense of, you know, forceful confidence actually comes from an inner feeling of lack of confidence. You know. So I think it's part of the process of developing confidence. I don't think necessarily it's wrong. I think the problem can be that, especially if you're working super hard to convince others, you may be successful in convincing others because people tend to be fairly, you know, they don't think about it that much. They look at you, they say, "Oh, okay, looks like she knows what she's doing." But then, you know, have you really convinced yourself? I think keeping that conversation going, saying, you know, am I doing the right thing? Am I, you know, doing what I should be doing? Or is there some things I should be learning that I don't know? Or, you know, so I think just kind of asking yourself that question and being flexible with the answer and also being flexible to people's feedback, because people will tell you, you know, they'll give you feedback, and I think, you know, and if you're open to it, so.
You started out by saying, early on you said emptiness, and you equated it to the interconnectedness of things.
Mm-hmm.
And during my practice, I've gone, mentally I like the interconnectedness, the abstraction of it and so mm-hmm. forth. But at this point, I'm finding that for me, Zen is a little more black and white. And when I think of emptiness is just that. And
what's that?
Nothing to hold on to. So I mean, you know, meditation can be an experience of nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then everything else is added, and is behavior that's added on top of it. I mean, I find it very freeing. I think the emptiness doctrine is great, and I like to think of it in a very straightforward way, is that there's nothing to hold on to and there's nothing there. And if you think of it that way, there's really, if you can really embody that, there's really no place for things to stick, right? And that's a pretty good place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that and have small mind at the same time. I mean, you don't have to be, it's nothing sticking, but you can still go in the HOV lane. You know, you can be in a hurry. You can walk fast without being in a rush. Right?
Yes.
I mean, I think you can do those things simultaneously. And that's what I'm saying is, it's a physical presence. It's not an abstraction.
Yes.
It is true emptiness with nothing to stick, and you still have to get across the street. Right. So.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Just a thought I had.
Yes.
Something that I've been thinking of and sort of trying out a little bit lately.
Yes. Yes. You know, it's absolutely, absolutely. Yes, yes, and yes.
Okay. Thank you.